tenderly to my belly, enjoying the last moments of having my daughters swimming inside, still truly a part of my flesh and blood, incapable of surviving without me. Though for weeks I had worried about the pain of labor, I felt no panic, no fear, only the quiet might of motherhood. I would protect these children with every ounce of strength I had, using all of my muscles to push them out into the world, the very force of my love keeping them safe once they blinked in the cold light of day. In the weeks that followed, I didn't always feel strong. I was tired, beyond exhausted. One of the girls constantly at my breast, the other one sleeping. Never enough time to refill my reserves of energy or milk. But I would remember those last moments in the kitchen. "You are stronger than you think," I whispered to both my babies and myself as a mouth latched onto my breast for the fourth time in as many hours. I repeated these words when I felt weakest, most frightened, most overwhelmed by this job that millions of women before me had done, but still seemed insurmountable every day. "You are stronger than you think. You are stronger than you think," I whispered to Mia now, so quietly that she didn't even stir. "Remember that." She slept soundly, oblivious to my presence, or perhaps comforted by it. Shadows of Lottie caught me off guard every now and then, her presence hovering nearby in Mia's features, in the cushion of the rocking chair, by the well-stocked changing table. Perhaps Lottie wasn't stronger than she realized. Perhaps Lottie's secret knowledge was that she was weaker than she wanted to be. I went into the living room, sat down on the couch with the baby in my arms, and called my sister. This time, she answered on the second ring.
"Francie."
Though she sounded tired, I heard the smile in her voice.
"Are you okay?"
I spoke softly so as not to wake Mia, but I was on the verge of tears.
"I'm fine. Well, not fine. I have a broken arm and a fractured ankle. I look like I got the shit kicked out of me, but I'm not going to die."
I took a shaky breath, reassured for the first time since receiving Sally's call. "I'm at your apartment, with Mia."
"Oh, good. I was worried."
Her casualness was jarring. "Sally's fine as a sitter, but she's not you." Somehow, we were able to do this. It had been months since we'd last spoken, but it felt like no time at all.
"Lottie, you have a baby. I didn't even know."
"Let's not do this now, Francie. There's plenty of time for that later. Is she okay?" I bit back my words and questions. "She's perfect. She's asleep in my arms right now. I'll get her ready and we'll come by the hospital."
"There's no rush. Let her sleep. I'm going to take a nap myself. I'll see you later though, okay?"
"Okay." I looked around the apartment, readying myself to tackle the mess. I'd closed the door to the kitchen, but would have to start in there.
"And Francie, I'm glad you're here. Thank you for coming."
She hung up before I had time to answer. I put Mia to bed and then cleaned the apartment. I wiped down the kitchen and took out the garbage and opened the doors and windows to shoo out the fruit flies. I organized the hundreds of student papers into neat stacks and threw out sour milk and old takeout containers. Lined up on the top row inside the refrigerator were several bags full of pumped breast milk. The date and time were clearly labeled in black Sharpie on each one in Lottie's careful script, the most recent dating back only a few days. When I opened the freezer, I found an entire rack filled with frozen milk. The sight of all those bags lined up neatly, nearly a month's worth, chilled me. I finally called home. Mark answered on the first ring. Are you okay? How's your sister?
She's going to be all right. I'm going to head to the hospital soon, but I talked to her and she sounded okay. I settled onto the plush green couch and let my head lean back against the velour cushions.
What happened?
I don't know yet. I'll find out when I see her. I'm just waiting for Mia to wake up from her nap.
Who?
I told him about Mia, but not her name. Lottie's baby girl, Mia.
Right.
Mark was silent on the other end.
So then Lottie must have been pregnant when you were there last spring.
Yeah, a few months along.
You couldn't tell?
No, I couldn't. My voice rose and I struggled to suppress the anger that quickly swelled. She wasn't even showing then.
Who's the father?
No one. She went through a sperm donor. I thought of the sleeping baby in the other room. She's so beautiful, Mark. She's like a tiny little Lottie. I forgot how tiny they are. Do you remember when Anna and Autumn were 5 months?
Yeah, I remember. They were pretty incredible.
I lay down on the couch and closed my eyes. We were silent on the line. I'm afraid she did it on purpose, I said after a moment.
What?
Lottie. I'm afraid she got hit on purpose.
Oh, Francie. Why do you think that?
You should have seen her apartment, Mark. I began to cry. It was a mess. It looked like she hadn't cleaned it in months. Except for Mia's room. Mia's room was perfect. And in the freezer, she had all this milk stocked up. Like she knew she wasn't going to be around.
I wiped my eyes with the back of my hand. But don't lots of women store their milk? Especially if she's back at work. She'd need to bring it for daycare, right?
Yeah, I guess.
And maybe the house just got messy. It's gotta be hard being a single parent, working full-time, Mark went on.
Yeah.
I didn't tell him about the overflowing trash and the rotten food. I wanted to believe him. He knew about her bipolar disorder and understood it on an intellectual level, yet he'd never seen her in the throes of either depression or mania. It was impossible to explain that it was something dangerous and separate from Lottie, yet it was also who she was. Mark had never really known Lottie, had never known what she was capable of. I always choreographed my visits to California during times when I knew he'd be unable to come. And on the few instances when Lottie visited us, I was a careful buffer between them, filling our evenings with activities that wouldn't involve Mark. Easier on everyone to keep them apart. How are the girls? I asked.
They're fine. They miss you.
I miss them too.
Francie, do you want me to come out there? Should we all come to you?
No, I said quickly. I didn't want them here, though I didn't know why exactly. The idea of Mark and Anna and Autumn all crowding into Lottie's neglected little apartment, of Mark's laptop and piles of paperwork scattered across her kitchen and the girls' toys strewn across Mia's room, somehow it just didn't feel right. No, I'm okay.
Francie, are you sure? I can help with the baby. I'm sure the girls will want to meet her.
Not yet. I ached suddenly for my own daughters, for their golden hair to be draped over my shoulder, their strong arms coiled around my neck. Please, can I talk to the girls?
Mommy!
Their voices, suddenly on the line, sounded so close. It was hard to believe how far away they actually were. I listened to them, asked questions, told them I loved them, missed them, would be home soon, and then I was alone again. The room was silent. Mia slept on. Lottie. Mia came to me on September 7th. I was in the baby's room, folding clothes into tiny little stacks of onesies and sleep suits to put in her drawers. I was 42 weeks and 2 days pregnant, and I'd been having contractions since that afternoon. The late-day sun poured through the window, casting shadows across the slats of the crib. A light breeze blew the mobile, and I took a deep breath as a stronger contraction twisted through my body. I picked my phone up from the dresser and dialed the number of my midwife.
Hello, Luann. It's Charlotte Weaver.
Hi, Charlotte. Is it time?
I think so. I've been having contractions since this morning. They're getting stronger.
I was suddenly on the verge of tears. Okay, it sounds like it's time.
Oh, my God.
I clutched the phone against my ear as I eased myself into the rocking chair I'd bought for the room. I was about to have a baby, and I was all alone. Whit and I had broken up several months earlier. I hadn't spoken to Francie since April. I felt more cut off than I'd ever felt in my life. Yet at the same time, there was something truly freeing about being alone, as if I'd lifted my anchor and set sail. I was both relishing the feeling of being suspended on the open ocean and terrified that I would drown. I had set out for the middle of the ocean, and now I was going to try to swim ashore with a child clinging to my back. The plan to have a baby had grown more frightening from the day the little plastic stick showed a pink plus sign. A part of me regretted it already.
Oh, no, no. You don't understand, I would tell Luann. I'm not fit to be a mother. Even my own sister won't trust me with her children anymore.
But another part of me still wanted it desperately. I wanted someone to love. Someone who would tether me to this world without confining me in the way that Francie and Whit did. Someone I could take care of rather than to always be the one in need. But what could Luann do? What could anyone do? Mia was on her way.
Oh, my God,
I repeated. Charlotte, are you okay? Luann asked. Are the contractions bad?
No.
I pressed my palms to my eyes and forced myself to breathe more steadily.
I'm just freaking out a tiny bit.
Hang in there, Charlotte. I'm on my way. You're going to make a wonderful mother.
At my first obstetrician's appointment, the doctor advised me to continue taking my medication throughout the pregnancy, with a few minor tweaks to dosages and prescriptions. After the appointment with the OBGYN, I was ushered down the hall to meet Luann, the midwife. Compared to the sterility of the doctor's office, Luann's office was warm and homey, with photos of newborn babies and crayon illustrations decorating the wall. Luann was in her late 50s, and she wore her long, graying blonde hair in a loose ponytail. She held my hand while I told her about my bipolar disorder. Even on that first visit, she told me that I would be a good mother. Some days, her words were like balm to a burn. Other days, they were meaningless. I thought about my own mother, as I had so often during the past 9 months. Had she felt like a good mother? Was she a good mother? I clasped my hands over my belly and remembered the stories of the Strout girls that she would tell Francie and me at bedtime. She'd sit on a yellow wooden chair between our beds. The room was thick with the smell of the menthol cigarettes she smoked when our father wasn't home, which was often.
Once, in a place that is not here and now, but is very close, once there lived two girls.
The stories were always about Louisa and Mirabella Strout. Mirabella had the ability to read minds and to plant new thoughts in other people's brains, while Louisa was able to make herself and others invisible. They lived in a brownstone in Boston with their parents, and in their stories, it was always winter, the streets of Boston covered in a thick layer of snow. Nearly every night, the girls were summoned on one adventure or another. They would open the window of their bedroom, join hands,
and push off the ledge as if they were in a swimming pool. They would fly through the starry sky above the white city, ready to save small children or animals or people or just regular grown-ups that were sad. There was a story where Louisa and Mirabella saved the homeless man who was about to freeze to death and brought him into their bedroom, hiding him in the closet for weeks while they gave him Tupperware containers filled with leftover roast chicken and slices of chocolate cake. Then there was the one where they saved the stray cats that were about to be taken to the pound to be put down. Louisa made them invisible, while Mirabella planted the idea in the pound worker's mind that stray cats were a good thing because they kept the city free of rats. The stories were usually dark and involved the downtrodden and the possibility of death. Usually they revealed some sinister irony about life that Francie and I didn't fully understand. How a man could die while sleeping on the sidewalk when there was a house with a warm bed right next to him, or why a city worker would round up a bunch of animals only to kill them. However, Louisa and Mirabella always prevailed and saved the day at the last minute. Our mother sat between us and told the stories night after night, perhaps emulating what she thought a good mother should do. But did she know that the stories sometimes gave Francie nightmares? Did she know that she often told the same story two nights in a row? Or was she trying to teach us that the world was full of magic and there was darkness behind every curtain, but the light could sometimes be found too? Had she failed terribly as a mother, or had she succeeded? I still wasn't sure.
Charlotte, did you hear me?
Luann's voice gently tugged me back to the present.
I said you're going to be a wonderful mother. Now you just need to calm down and breathe.
Thank you, Luann. Thank you. I'll see you in a little while.
Help me, I called silently to Francie, and I wished that I was Mirabella. I wished that I could pluck those two words out of the air and drop them into her mind.
But Francie had always related more to Louisa, the invisible twin, and so I couldn't find her anywhere. Mia was born, and Francie wasn't there. It seemed unbelievable that when the most important moment of my life occurred, Francie knew nothing about it. I wanted to tell her. I had tried during her visit in April, but I kept it to myself for the first few days. I was already a few months along, but no one knew, not even Whit. I was waiting to tell Francie, wanting the moment to be just right. Truth be told, even while I held the secret knowledge of Mia close and waited for that right moment, part of me was already afraid to tell her, just as I was afraid to tell Whit. I knew the doubt and judgment I would see in her eyes when I revealed my news. I couldn't bear to have Francie take that happiness away from me, replacing it with my own misgivings and fear that already lurked nearby. And then the visit went terribly wrong, and she left, suddenly. And there was no way I could tell her. I remember lying in the birthing center the morning after Mia was born, her tiny red body pressed to my skin. Already she had a full head of hair, and she slept peacefully after the 15-hour journey it took to find her way into my arms. I imagined Mia's exquisite nails, each perfectly formed, her lovely mouth and miniature ears. I watched her sleep and thought of Francie, missing her desperately and wishing she were here. But another part of me was angry. See what you've missed, I wanted to tell her. See what you've lost. And then another part of me just wondered, how did we get here? And will we ever find our way back? But Francie's answer to that question seemed to reverberate in my brain. Back to where? She would ask. Francie. Lottie was always the smart one. In high school, she pulled straight A's, while my own report card was a mediocre collection of B's. She worked hard and studied like crazy, but even without the effort, Lottie would have done fine. In college and graduate school, she threw herself into her studies with a passion and focus that I envied. Somehow, even during most of her days in the black, Lottie managed to make it work, rallying to give lectures to groups of 100 or more undergrads. I wondered if her students noticed her heavy lids and flat affect. Lottie's expertise was in American feminist writers of the 19th and 20th centuries. Shortly after she was hired as an associate professor, I sat in on one of her classes. That day, they were reading a short story by Charlotte Perkins Gilman called The Yellow Wallpaper. I'd read the story as an undergrad. It was about a woman whose husband brings her to the countryside after the birth of her child to recuperate. Allowed to do little other than lie in bed, the woman fixates on the yellow wallpaper in her room, becoming convinced that there's a woman living in it. The story chronicles the woman's slow and torturous descent into madness. It is both sad and deeply disturbing. Nervous breakdown, Lottie addressed the class. Depression, anxiety, a temporary nervous condition, postpartum depression. She paused, scanning the class for understanding. What is wrong with the woman in the yellow wallpaper? The class shifted in their seats. Several students muttered under their breath, "She's crazy." Lottie knew the names of every single person in each of her classes, even in this lecture with over 100 students. I knew that if no one raised a hand, she'd choose a student at random, and I prayed she wouldn't call on me as a joke. Finally, a student a few rows back raised her hand. Lottie nodded at the young woman.
She starts off just tired, and she's not interacting with her baby. She's probably suffering from postpartum depression.
Her voice went up at the end, indicating she wasn't certain of this. Looking to Lottie for confirmation, though Lottie didn't respond.
But then she becomes obsessed. She thinks there's a woman in the wallpaper.
A sign of madness? Lottie asked. It must have taken courage to stand before this packed lecture hall, yet my sister was utterly in control.
Well, no, the student conceded. Not on its own. But the narrator convinces herself there's a real woman in the wallpaper, alive and trapped behind bars.
The student tapped a pencil on her desk. Lottie nodded. Is this a reliable narrator? There were murmurs of no, and I watched most of the students shake their heads. When do we learn that we can trust this character to tell her own story accurately? Lottie waited, raising her pencil and getting ready to call on someone. A blonde guy raised his hand before the pencil fell.
When she first describes the wallpaper, that's when you start to know that something's not quite right with her. By the end of the story, she's become the woman in the wallpaper, and she escapes. She's finally free.
So is she free, or is she crazy? Lottie asked. The question hung unanswered in the hushed lecture hall. I thought of Lottie during her spells of depression, staring blankly at the water stains on the ceiling. I wondered what it was she saw there. Afterward, we ate lunch in the student union.
You were amazing!
I placed a tray between us on the table.
Thanks.
Lottie reached for one of the yogurts.
Really? You seemed so confident, so sure of yourself up there. Don't you get nervous?
Lottie looked up in surprise. Why would I get nervous? I've read the stories. I understand them.
I know, but I would be intimidated in front of such a big group of people.
Lottie shrugged. You get used to it, she said, removing a turkey sandwich from her canvas shoulder bag and giving me half.
What do you think actually happens at the end of the story? I asked.
She commits suicide.
Lottie's tone was matter-of-fact. Peeking out from the sleeves of Lottie's blouse were a few of the pale white flecks on her arms. The faint scars from the night I'd accompanied her to the ER. The sandwich felt thick in my mouth, and I forced myself to swallow it. Around us, the union hummed with students and professors relaxing between classes. People sat in small groups or alone with books spread across tables. Lottie and I met here for lunch most afternoons, though during this particular week, my supervisor was taking vacation, which allowed me the time off to sit in on Lottie's class. Lately, I found myself dreaming of moving to Boston, the city our mother had left so many years earlier and never found her way back to. I knew I was being overly romantic, but I pictured brownstones and oak trees covered in red and yellow leaves, wide streets dotted with white colonials, their shutters painted forest green, and sidewalks dappled with the sunlight that flickered through thick foliage. I had only been to Boston once, on a trip with my father and Lottie the autumn after Mother's death. Our father was presenting his research at Harvard, and Lottie and I wandered through Harvard Square and Harvard Yard. It had been a damp, gray October morning, and leaves lay scattered upon the grass. Despite the rush of city life just beyond, the yard had been quiet and serene, as if even the tourists knew better than to disturb the serious hum of academia that went on within the red brick walls. We stayed in a hotel in Black Bay that overlooked the public garden. In the mornings, while our father was in the hotel hunched over his notebooks, Lottie and I bought cups of hot chocolate and donuts from a street vendor and ate breakfast in the garden. We sat on a bench and watched the ducks, the tourists, the businessmen, and vagrants as they each made their way through the sanctuary of the park toward downtown crossing. I pictured our mother here, walking through the garden, dressed in the red and orange wool that conjures a New England autumn. I missed her intensely, and I leaned against Lottie, my head falling on her shoulder. Neither of us said anything, but I knew she was thinking of Mother as well. I reached for Lottie's hand and squeezed it, silently promising our mother I'd return here someday. But that was before. Before Lottie's first episode. Before the spells in Lottie's life, and by extension, my own. We were broken into black, white, and the calm of gray. Sitting in the union, talking about suicide so cavalierly, I tried to summon the courage to tell her I wanted to move. "Do you like teaching?" I asked instead. "I do." Lottie was thoughtful for a moment. "It's kind of a rush, having everyone in the room focus on you like that. It sounds kind of twisted, but there's a neat sense of power." Lottie flashed a wicked grin and took a sip of soda. The year before, I'd applied to art school without telling anyone, not even Lottie. Not when I applied or when the four programs rejected me. I'd taken art classes throughout high school and college, yet I chose not to major in art once at Berkeley. It felt too impractical, too self-indulgent, too much like something Lottie would have done. So I majored in journalism instead, taking art classes on the side. But when I looked back on my best memories of college, most of them had taken place in the early evening hours at a studio, light filtering through the plastic blinds, a bouquet of flowers propped at the center of the room, and the whole class silent as we focused intently on the thick piece of canvas before us. I could easily conjure up the slightly musty odor of the room, the smell of charcoal dust, paint, and linseed oil mixed with the rich scent of coffee that came from the numerous paper cups that sat beside our easels. The memories always filled me with a deep sense of contentment and optimism, and it was with great trepidation that I put together my portfolio and sent out the applications. It shouldn't have been a surprise when I didn't get in. An art major was a prerequisite for most of the programs. My portfolio was thin, considering I'd only taken one class a semester, and though my recommendations were solid, behind each lay what wasn't written, what I'd been told in all of my classes. I needed to take more risks in my work. I hadn't expected the crushing sense of disappointment when the slender envelopes arrived in the mailbox, one after the other, or the heavy sense of defeat that followed each rejection. I threw the letters out at work, afraid Lottie would come across them in our apartment. I continued in my job, determined that my days of art were behind me, even as it became clear that they'd never been in front of me. It took me almost a year to muster up the courage to apply to grad school again, though I stayed away from art this time. I could become a teacher, I decided. Safe and predictable. A good schedule for when I got married and had children. I scrutinized the prerequisites for the teaching programs before getting my materials together, though again, I didn't tell Lottie that I was applying. The week before, a fat yellow envelope arrived at work with a return address of Boston University. "I've been thinking that maybe I'd like to teach, too," I said. "Really?" Lottie's thin eyebrows raised in surprise. She leaned forward, reaching for my hand. "You'd be great, Francie. What are you thinking of teaching, journalism?" I shook my head. "No, I was thinking high school. English, probably." "That's fabulous!" Her enthusiasm was so real, I hated to ruin it. "You could probably even start on your master's this spring. I don't think Berkeley typically accepts students for the second semester, but they might make an exception for you, considering how long you've been here." "I don't want to go to Berkeley," I said, looking down at my hand still clasped gently in Lottie's. She tilted her head to the side. "No. They have an excellent education department. But maybe you want to change? Dad might be able to help get you into Stanford. It's kind of a long shot, but you never know. And there's always USF or San Francisco State." I shook my head, staring down at the plastic table. "No, I don't think I want to go anywhere in California." I forced myself to continue. "I want to go to Boston." I looked up. She frowned at me in confusion, her eyes narrowing slightly behind the black frames of her glasses. "Boston?" Lottie asked skeptically. "You do realize it's freezing there, don't you?" I attempted a small smile. "I know. But I've always wondered what it would be like to live through a real New England winter." I waited a beat before adding, "And I was accepted at Boston University." "You already applied?" she asked, clearly taken aback. I nodded, swallowing my guilt. "But Francie..." Lottie trailed off, a frantic look suddenly in her eyes. "What about me?" "What about Lottie?" I didn't have an answer. I was silent. "But, Francie..." I felt her panic as it descended. It shivered in the pit of my own stomach, a small abandoned bird. "What about me?" she asked again. I hadn't let myself believe in the idea. Like my instructors had said, I didn't know how to take risks. I shook my head, a foolish smile spreading across my face, assuring Lottie this was all a misunderstanding. In my mind, I was already sliding the acceptance letter from BU into the recycling bin by my desk. "Forget it. It was just an idea. You're right. Berkeley has a great education program." I shook my head again, as if shaking the remainder of the idea away. Lottie eyed me warily. "Really? Just like that?" "Yes, really. It was just a thought." "You were accepted at Boston University? When?" last week. It doesn't matter, though. I have plenty of time to get my application in here. I began to gather our garbage on the tray, eager now to end the conversation. You were really thinking about moving? Just for a minute, but not anymore. Lottie looked at the clock on the wall. I need to get going. I have office hours in 15 minutes. I'm gonna grab a cup of coffee first. Lottie got in line, and I finished clearing our table. It had been a silly idea, I tried to convince myself. I would probably have hated the cold winters, and I'd heard the summers were sweltering. Better off staying right here in sunny, mellow California. I ignored the lump that had formed at the back of my throat as the half-hatched plan cracked from its egg. A moment later, Lottie appeared with a cup of coffee. Maybe it's not the worst idea in the world, she said, handing me a chocolate chip cookie wrapped in a napkin. I reached for it without speaking, waiting for her to continue. Maybe it would be okay if you tried a new city. It's not as if I'm helpless here, right? Of course not, I said quickly. I've been good, right? I'm taking my meds. I haven't been off them in almost a year. And I'm not going to, she said firmly. I nodded. And things with Whit have been great. He's really supportive. Not that he's responsible for me. He shouldn't be. That's not fair. Lottie paused, realizing what she was implying. Not that you should be responsible for me either. It's okay. I don't mind. We walked toward the stairwell, and I linked my arm through Lottie's to show her that I really didn't mind. Did I? Most days, I wasn't sure. I can't imagine being so far away from you. It would be too weird. Lottie's heels clicked along the stairs, and my clogs made a heavy scraping sound. I tightened my grip on her arm. It would be strange to be so far away from her. It would be terrifying. But part of me had looked forward to that rootless feeling and the exhilarating freedom I imagined came with it. I pushed open the heavy metal doors and stepped out into the afternoon. It was mid-November, but the sun still carried heat. Along the wide swaths of green, students sat cross-legged, bent over textbooks, or they lay in the grass, backpacks tucked under their heads as makeshift pillows. This was where we parted most afternoons before making our way toward our respective departments. But Lottie stood on the pavement, her book bag slung across her body and her coffee in her hand. She looked deep in thought, but she turned to me. You should go. Her voice held an air of finality, as if she'd been thinking about this for a long time and not just during the walk through the cafeteria and down the stairs. Lottie closed her eyes and tilted her face up to catch the warmth of the sun's rays, and her pale skin was bathed in the vivid light of the afternoon. She nodded again, her eyes still closed. You should go, she repeated. I was silent, waiting for her to take it back, but she didn't. Not then, and not ever, though I'm sure she must have wanted to many times. For once, I didn't protest. Thank you, I whispered instead, leaning forward to embrace my sister, planting a clumsy peck on her parted lips. Later, when I thought about my decision to move to Boston, I remembered that afternoon and the generous and selfless gift Lottie had bravely imparted to me. I pictured my confident, brilliant, terrified, and changeable sister, and how she had looked up at the sky that afternoon, ready to face any uncertainty. She looked like an angel. Her hair around her face, the white glow that her skin gave off, the serene look of calm as she braced herself for whatever might come next. In the weeks before I left California, our apartment was filled with boxes to be shipped and bags to be donated. The furniture in my bedroom would stay. Lottie had decided not to take a roommate and to convert it into a guest room. for when you come to visit, she said. The evening before my flight, we ate dinner with our father in a small Italian place in Palo Alto. Lottie had been chattering away all night in an effort to distract us from the reason we were out. When she went to the bathroom, the table took on an awkward quiet.
You all ready for tomorrow morning?
My father asked, stabbing a squiggly calamari from the appetizer plate we were sharing. I think so. I was ready to leave, tired of imagining all the reasons why I should stay. You'll keep an eye on Lottie, won't you? I asked.
Of course.
Though he knew of her diagnosis, Lottie and I had worked hard to keep the ugliness of it from touching our father. As far as he was concerned, her little mood disorder was fully under control with the medication that she took daily without complaint. There was no reason for it to be otherwise. We'll have to plan a trip for both of you to come visit, I said. My father smiled and nodded noncommittally. A slight sheen of olive oil clung to the stubble of his beard.
Your mother would be proud of you, he said.
I looked down at my plate, unsure why the words left me feeling so empty. When I arrived in Boston, I was surprised how at home I felt right away. It was late August and the trees were still green, though here and there leaves lay in scattered brown clusters on the sidewalks. The temperature was a comfortable 75, much like Berkeley when I'd left. My new roommates, Heidi and Jan, were friends from the University of Massachusetts and several years younger than me, and I liked them immediately. Within a few weeks, we developed systems for cleaning the house, buying groceries, and splitting the cost of the bills. At night, we gathered around a second-hand table in the kitchen, drinking cheap red wine from ceramic mugs. For the first time in a while, I felt young. Winter approached quickly, and I wondered how I would endure the bracing New England cold. But again, I was surprised at how easily I adapted. Heidi and Jan were skiers, and they invited me to New Hampshire over winter break. Never having been on skis before, I assumed I would be clumsy and embarrassed. But I loved the thrill of the icy air on my face as I rushed down the mountain alone. I spoke with my father once a week and with Lottie nearly every day. She, too, seemed happy, at peace, her intense nature possibly mellowed by my absence. I met Mark at the registrar's office one morning in late February. It was a bitterly cold day, and I was wearing several layers, but after standing in the long line, I was sweating and lightheaded. Perspiration prickled at my neck in the overly heated room, and I began to strip the winter clothes off slowly. First the hat, then a few minutes later I unwound the scarf from my neck. Mark was ahead of me, and he smiled as I took off my heavy coat, stepping out of line to put my pile of clothes on an empty chair. There were still several students in front of us, one of whom had been speaking with the sole assistant at the window for nearly 10 minutes. I smiled back at Mark, who looked cool and comfortable in a fleece jacket.
You've got to love February in New England, he said with a grin.
It's my first, I told him.
Oh, yeah? Where are you from?
California, Berkeley. His eyebrows went up in amusement, as they often did when I told people I was from Berkeley. People in New England assumed that everyone in Berkeley grew their own wheatgrass and fueled their cars with vegetable oil. One girl I met had asked me if it was true that you were allowed to go to class topless at Berkeley. It took another 25 minutes before it was Mark's turn, and by then he'd asked me out for the next night. We went for Chinese food, and the night after that we went to a movie. A few nights later, he cooked dinner for me at his apartment, and I surprised myself by sleeping with him. There was something about Mark, like Boston, that allowed me to be free. I wanted to call Lottie the next morning to tell her, but I kept it to myself,
worried that she'd accidentally ruin it with her automatic criticism. As far as Lottie was concerned, no one was ever good enough. Lottie met Mark for the first time when she came to visit that June. I wanted her to love Boston as I did, for her to see just how quaint and charming it could be. Though it was only the third week in June, the temperature was in the low 90s, and Lottie had been complaining about the heat since she arrived. My apartment had no air conditioning, and the small window fans did little to relieve the thick humidity. We made plans to meet Mark for dinner at one of his favorite Italian restaurants. The train had no air conditioning, and with transfers, stops, and wait time, it took over an hour to get from Alston to the North End. I was relieved that the restaurant was air-conditioned, and Lottie collapsed into the booth in a sticky heap. Mark joined us a few minutes later, kissing me before acknowledging Lottie. I felt a secret thrill to be the center of his attention, aware of Lottie watching the kiss.
"You must be Lottie," Mark said,
turning and extending his hand. "It's Charlotte, actually. Francie's the only one who still calls me Lottie."
"It's nice to meet you, Charlotte."
He settled into the booth beside me, letting his hand rest on my bare knee under the table. He looked from Lottie to me, and then back at Lottie.
"You two really do look identical. It's kind of weird."
Lottie shrugged and raised her eyebrows. She wore a black sundress, and the skin of her chest was flushed pink. Her hair was in a frizzy pile on top of her head, and her upper lip was damp with sweat. Unlike me, Mark had a car, and he'd driven from work. He looked comfortable and handsome, and I felt a ripple of pride to be with him. "Francie tells me you're from around here," she said, holding her glass of ice water to her forehead.
"New Hampshire, originally. And then Framingham. Not far from here."
Lottie rolled her eyes to the ceiling. "I can't imagine living in a place where it was this hot." Mark raised his eyebrows.
"Doesn't it get hot in California?"
The waiter came, and Mark ordered a bottle of wine. "I live in Northern California. We rarely get temperatures like this," Lottie corrected. "And I'll have a gin and tonic first, please," she told the waiter. I fought the urge to question whether that was a good idea. Lottie wasn't supposed to drink with her medication, but she often did. A glass of wine here or there wasn't usually a problem, but the doctor had been stern when he talked about hard alcohol, and Lottie was never able to do anything in moderation. "When Francie said she wanted to move here, I didn't understand it," Lottie continued. "I know our mother was from here originally, but I've never had much of an interest in living in a place where it's freezing cold for half the year and 100 degrees the other half."
"That's not true, Lottie," I objected. "Fall is beautiful here. Remember when we were here with Dad?"
Lottie shrugged her shoulders. "And there's spring."
"Isn't it spring now?"
Lottie asked with a slight sneer. Our drinks came, and Lottie squeezed the lime into her cocktail, taking a large slug. I sipped my white wine, and we silently studied the menu. Over dinner, Mark asked Lottie about her job at Berkeley. Lottie answered him perfunctorily, not going into much detail.
"Francie tells me you're getting your MBA."
I detected the note of distaste in her voice.
"I actually just graduated."
I'd attended the graduation the previous month and sat beside Mark's mother in the stadium seats. She had leaned over and squeezed my hand when they called Mark's name.
"Planning on ruling the world, are you?" Lottie asked.
"Lottie!" I shot her a look across the table. Mark frowned at her with an amused smile on his face.
"Excuse me?"
"Well, that is why people get MBAs, isn't it? To make enough money to squish the little guy?" Lottie pressed. Mark didn't take the bait. He shrugged and tilted his head.
"I assume people get MBAs for many different reasons."
I got mine because I've always been interested in business and because I didn't want a job where I was always worried about how I was going to pay my rent. He could have told Lottie that he'd watched his mother do that after his father died, that his family was forced to sell their house and move in with his grandmother, and that he'd shared a bedroom with his sister in high school. But I knew he didn't want to give Lottie the justification for his decisions. As he told me later, his choices were ultimately none of her goddamn business.
"A job like teaching, you mean?" Lottie asked, signaling to the waiter for another drink.
"I imagine that you probably do all right as a professor at Berkeley."
"Associate professor," Lottie interrupted.
"On the tenure track, from what I hear. Which is pretty impressive for someone your age. But if not, you can always consider going back for your MBA. Berkeley has a great business school."
I knew he was teasing. He was baiting her, as she was baiting him. But Lottie didn't get the joke. "I love my job. I would never give it up just for more money. For some of us, how we make our money is just as important as how much we make."
Lottie snapped. I cringed inwardly at her self-righteous tone. Had she always been like this, I wondered? Was she louder, brassier, more outspoken than usual? Or had I just forgotten? The rest of the dinner passed in an awkward silence interrupted by meaningless small talk. Under the table, Mark kept his hand on my knee, only removing it to take a sip from his glass. Its warm presence steadied me enough to get me through the meal without bursting into tears or throwing something at Lottie. Finally, our plates were empty except for a few strands of noodles and the pink tails of shrimp.
"Do either of you want dessert?" Mark asked.
Both Lottie and I shook our heads, and Mark signaled to the waiter for the check. He paid with his credit card, and I didn't know if I was relieved or ashamed that for all her mockery of Mark's financial ambitions, Lottie didn't once reach for her purse. He drove us back to my apartment and kissed me slowly, deliberately, even though Lottie was waiting impatiently on the sidewalk. Later, while Lottie was showering, I called him.
"I'm sorry about dinner," I apologized. "I don't know why she acted that way. She's not usually like that."
I wondered if this were true.
"It's okay. It seemed like she'd made her mind up about me before I actually sat down."
"I really wanted you two to like each other."
I pulled my knees to my chest and leaned back in bed. In the bathroom down the hall, the water turned off.
"I'm sure we will. First impressions aren't everything."
"I know, but she's my twin sister. She means a lot to me," I persisted. "It's important to me that you like her. I just wish she hadn't been such a jerk."
"At least she lives in California, right?"
Mark said lightly. I tried not to let the comment rattle me. Seemingly innocent, it contained so much. An assumption that I belonged here and would stay. That this was only the beginning for us. But also that Mark was relieved that Lottie wouldn't be around very often.
"I guess."
A shadow moved in the slant of light under the bedroom door. Outside, raindrops began to fall.
"Anyway, I'm sorry about tonight. Maybe we can try again before she leaves?"
"Maybe."
He paused, and when he spoke again, his voice was softer, more serious.
"But you know it doesn't really matter, Francie. I may never be best friends with your sister, but I know she's important to you. And I love you. That's what matters."
He never told me he loved me before, and I actually felt my jaw drop just as Lottie opened the door to the bedroom. She stood in a towel, dripping water onto the floor.
"Okay,"
I whispered, wanting to say the words back to him, but not wanting Lottie there for it. Mark was silent on the other end.
"Me too," I managed.
"Lottie just came in," I explained. "We're about to go to bed."
"Okay. I'll talk to you tomorrow, Francie."
he said, and then hung up. I held on to the phone, willing myself back to the place just moments before. I looked up at Lottie, ready to tell her, but her eyes were dark. Were you apologizing for me? What? I asked, though I'd heard the question clearly. You said you were sorry about tonight. What are you sorry about, Francie? Lottie's eyes were narrow and beady, and I wondered if I looked the same when I was angry. Normally, Lottie's temper had the ability to jar me, but it was hard to take her seriously when she was wearing only a ratty old towel. And Mark's words had made me suddenly untouchable. For the way you behaved, I said, getting up off the bed and pulling pajamas from the drawer. You acted like a spoiled child. A child? Why, because I wasn't immediately impressed by him? Lottie threw the towel on the floor and walked naked across the room. She was beautiful in her fury, all curves and perfect posture, totally unabashed that people could likely see her through the flimsy white curtains. Lottie rummaged through my dresser until she found a t-shirt and shorts. Give me a break, Francie. You're the one who's acting like a child, all doe-eyed and in awe of Mr. MBA and his potential earnings. You're drunk, I said with mild disgust. Outside, it had begun to pour, and I closed the curtains. Down below, people were hurrying through the streets, trying uselessly not to get wet. Jesus, Francie, I am not. I had a few drinks. Will you relax already? You shouldn't be drinking, I said quietly. Spare me the lecture. We both stood by the bed, but neither of us made a move to get in. You shouldn't. It's not good for you. You know what the doctor said about drinking while on the medication. Yes, Francie, I know what the doctor said. He's my doctor. I should know what he said. You are still taking the medication, aren't you? I asked, the thought filling me with dread. Yes, I'm still taking it! Lottie's cheeks were pink with anger. My God, you know nothing about it! I do, too. I felt my own face growing hot. I've been there, Lottie. I've seen you. I know a thing or two about it. Well, you're not there now, and I'm managing just fine. You're relieved of your duties, remember? The statement cut me to the quick. She let out a sigh and got into bed, scooting over to make room for me. I got in beside her and quickly turned out the light. We lay for a moment without talking. I'm okay, Francie. You don't need to worry all the time. I can take care of myself. Her voice drifted in the dark. No, you can't, I was tempted to say. But I stayed silent because if I really believed that, how could I ever have left? And Mark seems like a nice guy, she continued. I wasn't sure if she was telling the truth, but I appreciated the effort that I knew it took. He's not my type, but he seems to really care about you. He told me he loved me, I said. Oh, Francie, that's so good. She was quiet. You like it here? I do. Even more than I expected. It suits you, Lottie said, her voice already heavy with sleep. It's nice to see you so happy. As we talked, our bodies moved closer. With the rain, the heat had broken and a damp breeze drifted in the windows. I remembered the bedroom we'd shared for so many years in the old house, the one with the embroidered curtains and pale yellow carpet. I'm glad you're here, I whispered. Lottie murmured, nearly asleep. I lay awake, listening to the sounds of the city outside my window, and beside me, the steady sound of Lottie breathing in the noisy night. Lottie. Francie has always been cautious. She's always been scared to let the messiness of life get too close to her. But the one place in her life where she is strong and confident is in her mothering. While it took me a long time to realize I wanted to be a mother, Francie has known since she was a little girl. As a child, I was more interested in my easel and paints, my musical